They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WEBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Radio Fairfax, I'm Sue Bartholomew, and back by popular demand today, we have two attorneys, John Cowherz, in the studio with me, and Bill Davis is driving the wild roads of Texas, and he's joining us by cell phone. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello, Sue and John.
Hi, Sue and Bill. It's a pleasure to be back.
Just don't call me Mom, right?
Right.
Okay. All right. So I won't cut you off, Bill. One of the issues that John and I have been emailing back and forth, and we've been talking about confidentiality clauses, and I think we both have some pretty good reasons for and against them, and we thought that it might be fun to sort of hash these out so that you can hear what we're saying. And so we'll see where it takes us, and we'll go from there. John, you want to start the ball rolling here?
Sure. I think that the typical set of circumstances that many homeowners or other parties to lawsuits experience is that you have a conflict, whether it's with an HOA or with somebody else. That's escalating. Now, you can't agree on something, and you have meetings, and there's disagreements, people hire lawyers, one side files a lawsuit. The dispute becomes very entrenched, and there can sometimes be a lot of bitterness, and that just there's a trajectory to it. It kind of becomes more intense and more public because a public lawsuit is filed at the courthouse. And then, Bill maybe probably can attest to this as well, is that in many cases, at some point, there is a moment in the case in which it can be resolved and that the matter can be put to rest and that it's at least possible for the parties to come to a set of terms that maybe neither of them are completely 100% happy with, but both sides can live with. And this is usually in the party's better interest than fighting things out, to no end with trials and appeals and so on. It's every case and set of facts is different. But when this moment comes, quite often people who aren't experienced with the legal process are surprised when their opponent, whether it's an HOA or some other institutional party, puts into a settlement agreement a clause that to use Shu's term, puts a gag order on talking about some aspect of the case, whether it's disclosing the amount of money that's being transferred in settlement or prohibiting discussions about some kind of trade secret or financial information, or it could be something much broader about the facts of the case. And these requests for confidentiality in settlement don't always come up. Personally, in my opinion, the vast majority of cases, confidential settlements are completely unnecessary because when things are really put to bed and really resolved, then there's really no need to talk about it anymore, because it's, you know, people move on, and you know, it's just things that the air deflates out of the balloon. But then the question becomes, you know, when this request for confidentiality is presented, kind of what is, you know, a homeowner in a dispute with an HOA or anyone else to make of this request? Is this something good? Is it something negative? Is it something harmful? Or is it something that's kind of more neutral? So that's kind of what Shu and I had been talking about that we thought would make a great show.
We talked for hours, or we wrote a long time, and John just put it succinctly in just a few words. Thank you, John, for getting it down there. All right, Bill, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, if you're dealing with rational parties, okay, who are spending their own money, arbitration could be our alternative dispute resolution. By the way, I'm not sure if we were expanding this into both mediation and arbitration. But I'm not at all opposed to mediation. I think that that's very helpful. And even if you're in court, many jurisdictions are going to require you to go to mediation prior to a trial at any rate. So, but my issue is with arbitration. And I think, although there's an argument that, the homeowner, if there's money involved, might be able to get a larger monetary settlement if it's an arbitration, I don't think that's a reason to justify arbitration, because you can always have a settlement that is not subject to public review while the rest of the trial or the case is public record. And my concern is that keeping these things secret, like through arbitration, where the whole process is secret, basically, from anybody except for the parties, is detrimental to the rest of the homeowners, especially when you have a rogue board who, by the way, they're not spending their own money. They're spending somebody else's money, and they are often driven by ego and other non-rational. They'll spend every bit of your money till it's all gone. You know, they're not really necessarily rational, and so I'm not real fond of arbitration. The positive thing I can say about arbitration is that generally it's going to take less time, but taking less time and not getting the result you want is not necessarily a good thing. Declaring it to be over is not necessarily, you know, the homeowner's goal. And one of the big problems with arbitration, aside from not being public, that's a problem for the other homeowners. So how do you, for example, defenses like arbitrary and capriciousness, how can you show that if all the activities of the HOA board are secret? You know, and all the arbitration matters and all the proceedings are secret. How do you show arbitrary and capriciousness?
So you've taken us off into arbitration and less time. And I think a lot of people will grab that because they think that it's going to cost them less. It doesn't always cost them less.
Correct. I'm not necessarily saying cost less. I'm saying arbitration often has tighter time schedule once you pick, or the arbitration process. You'll choose arbitrators. You may have a pre-arbitration mediation requirement. There's typically a time scale. There's a time scale for the arbitrator to render a decision. And the arbitrator costs can be significant. They're always more significant than the court costs. And you have to pay your attorney's fees regardless of whether it's arbitration or court. But arbitration is not necessarily less expensive. And although a court may be more expensive if it's protracted litigation, typically it's drawn out over a period of time. Arbitration, you got to pay a lot of money up front. You got to pay your attorney. You got to pay the arbitrators. And all that has to be done up front.
So in arbitration, would you necessarily – is it in arbitration that you normally would have a confidentiality clause, or not necessarily?
Go ahead, John.
I think that before we move much further, it might be useful to kind of understand how do people end up in arbitration as opposed to ending up in court or some other way of resolving disputes. And in order to have an arbitration, you have to have an agreement to arbitrate. And that agreement is, if it's a commercial case, it's going to be the agreement between the buyer and the seller, whoever the parties are. In a homeowners association case, you would really need to have that arbitration clause in the HOA docs in order to make it something that's going to force the parties to go into arbitration. And it's very unusual for parties to just on their, you know, after the dispute is erupted, for them to mutually agree to arbitration, because by that time they don't want to agree about anything. So you first have to have an agreement in the governing documents that mandates arbitration, and then you've got to have that those provisions will talk about whether there is whether there is confidentiality. There is every arbitration organization has different rules that govern arbitration, and it may be that decisions about confidentiality may be decided by the arbitrator or by a court. Bill may be able to talk to that about how those issues pop up in his cases down in Texas.
Well, let me ask you, don't I have a right to go to court? I mean, isn't there a constitutional right that I be heard by my peers?
Just in the same way that you can contract away your property rights by buying into an HOA, you can contract away your day in court by...
So you're going to put this in, I know a lot of people are doing it. I mean, even if you buy toothpaste, it's on there. If you have a problem, you cannot sue us. You can go to arbitration. And therein lies yet another issue, another problem.
I'm not fond of arbitration being forced through restrictive covenants. In fact, I think I would like to see those voided. I think that if arbitration is going to be done, it should be done at the time of the dispute or that the parties elect it. Because if you think about it, the HOA itself didn't actually contract for it because those things were thrust upon it by the developer. Okay, typically, if it's in there from day one, the homeowner has absolutely no say in this thing. There's a stakeholder in there who stands to personally benefit from putting that provision in there that's not necessarily good for the HOA or for the homeowner. Really, CCRs are not. I don't understand they're interpreted as contracts. They're not contracts. You can't unilaterally amend anything. You can't negotiate anything, and you often never see it. And it relies upon basically somebody else to change them other than the homeowner. And in some cases, for example, the declarant can unilaterally change them for decades. In other cases, you have these where boards can adopt resolutions. And, I the homeowner's not agreed to that. And so I'm not real fond of those types of provisions. I agree 100% with John that about the agreement part, but the parties can agree. You can agree to arbitration any time. There's no reason why the parties can't. I realize there may be other factors there that tend to discourage it, but really it's the HOA and that industry that wants arbitration. It's not, the homeowner doesn't ordinarily, I don't think, want arbitration. If you look at CAI's public policies, here's the lobbying organization for management companies and HOA attorneys. Why do you think they're promoting ADR? The parties can always agree to go to ADR, and in fact, at least some part of ADR mediation is probably going to be required, even when you're in court.
I think that one of the things that I've seen in commercial cases is that organizations like auto dealerships, other companies, they don't want arbitration clauses in small cases. Like if you have a case for $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $25,000, they don't want those cases arbitrated because let's say they want to collect unpaid assessments against a homeowner, they don't want to have to go to arbitration to get an award for unpaid assessments. Now that's going to put a big price tag that the price tag might eclipse arbitration fees might eclipse the judgment that's rendered. So I think that there's really not an interest on the part of the industry to to put any brakes on what they're doing with having these kind of general district court type of cases arbitrated.
But John, what they do is they have an exception clause and say this doesn't apply for collection of assessments or foreclosure actions,
right?
Or enforcement actions. And it's like, okay, so really the only person bound is the homeowner, you know, for all practical purposes. But
before we started recording, Bill, you said you'd listened to the show with his name was Adam Buck from Arizona, who'd started this organization, and what he was trying to do was to get associations to include a requirement for arbitration in the governing documents. So they would be amending their governing documents, which is what John was talking about.
Right.
And that meant that, you know, regardless, you had to go to arbitration. And if you bought in the HOA, or even if you voted no for it, you know, they're reducing the quorum, or they're reducing what makes a majority in HOA. So, you know, two-thirds can take away a right that you have. That's what I have a problem with.
Right.
But let's go back to the gag orders and talk a little bit about that. Is it fair to have a gag order? Is it fair to the homeowners, the rest of the homeowners, who will probably be paying the cost of the settlement? Because here's the board running around doing what the board really wants to do, and it doesn't matter because they're not held accountable. They're never held accountable. Because heaven forbid, if you hold someone accountable, they might not want to run for the board, right? Isn't that the argument we keep hearing?
Yes.
So they use your money, and then they threaten you, and they bully you, and tell you you cannot tell anyone about it. You cannot disclose anything. But that doesn't mean that a board member cannot disclose it or doesn't disclose it. And some of the terms get out somehow. I think John has a case here that he'll probably be talking to us about in a minute. So, there's no real secure way of keeping that closed, not that there should be. But then they go after the homeowner again, and the homeowner hasn't done anything.
Okay, so what is your...
My point is, I think that if you're going to use your money to settle something, they ought to let you know what they're doing with your money.
Of course, they're going to take the position that once you paid it to them, it was their money, or to the organization's money.
Well, okay,
I'm just saying.
So you pay them to do something. Your assessments are going to maintain the roads, to repair the roof, whatever it is that you're paying your assessments for. They use that money for something else. And then when your roof springs a leak or your driveway is full of potholes, then they're going to come to you for yet more money. So what did you do with the money I already paid you to maintain that? I mean, the purpose of the assessment is, right? Isn't that in the declaration?
Yeah.
Well, you really shouldn't have a part in your budget for board misbehavior, right? There shouldn't be a line item in the annual budget that says, okay, well... we have a really lean budget this year, so we're only allocating $200,000 for settlements. You would think that if the budget process is working properly, that if you were going to have a big settlement, that it would have to, or a big judgment that have to be paid, there would have to be a special assessment that would have to be pushed through the association, and I don't see how you can get around getting that approved without having some kind of disclosure about it. You know, it's otherwise, and I suppose that, you know, it's
well, and not to mention it should appear in the financials anyway, right? I'm not talking about a budget, but I mean, if you're doing financial reporting, I know it's a nonprofit, but the equivalent of an income statement or a nonprofit doesn't mean you don't pay taxes. It's more of a state designation on a state-by-state basis, and it just means you can't distribute the money to the members for the most part, at least not most of the members. And if you spent money on a settlement, why shouldn't it show up in a financial report after the fact? Budget is for before the fact.
So you think that they're going to come up with a line item? We actually spent $100,000 to buy off your neighbor?
There should be one. There should be something that shows where the money went. And, I mean, for legal fees, they may not have it broken down on a case-by-case basis, but they could have, you know, X dollars spent on legal fees. Yeah, that should be in their financial reports.
The legal fees, and they'll just throw it in with the legal fees. Now, why are you spending that much on legal fees? Well, we were sued, but we took care of it. Don't worry about it.
One of the interesting things that many people don't know is that in many states, attorney invoices are not part of attorney-client privilege. And
right.
That in order to, and if you want to assert privilege to any of those things, then you have to redact out the privilege portions. And that, you know, judges, if you go to court and you want to get an award of attorney's fees and you submit, you know, just a piece of paper with a number on it, the judge is not going to give it. They want detail about what was done and why it was done and the invoices. You know, there's actually many attorneys that don't understand that. So there's at least an argument that can be made that in some instances those invoices are not, that they're not, they aren't protected from disclosure with the same sanctity as, let's say, an email between a lawyer and a client about sensitive matters about the case.
Who has the privilege? Is it the attorney or the client?
That's a very good question.
Yes.
I had a client one time sarcastically remarked about another attorney that they had in their professional failings and said, well, that's the attorney privilege or something like that. But
yeah.
But the attorney-client privilege is held by the client,
right?
And it's the duty of the lawyer to protect that duty, that confidentiality. It's not the lawyer's.
So I hire you and I pay you to do something, and then you say, well, you can't do that because you can't discuss it. You can't discuss it, but I can, since I bought it. I paid for it, right?
Well, we might have a conversation if you're going out and talking about all sorts of sensitive issues that might prejudice you later, but you know, it's held by the client.
By the client. So yeah, because I've heard a lot of attorneys say, "Oh, you can't discuss that. That's privilege." And so the clients think, "Oh, well, the attorney's going to get upset with me because I disclosed that." Well, you hold the privilege.
Well,
you own the privilege.
I mean, Bill can probably attest to this, that there's many situations in which the attorney will advise the client very strongly not to disclose certain things because of their sensitive nature, but in essentially what you're saying is correct.
Can you say that a little louder, John?
You're right.
Thank you. Yeah, because that's become, thank you for clarifying that, because that has become an issue, and so many people have talked about it and said, oh, no, the attorney says I can't discuss that because it's client privilege and he's going to get upset with me. No, you own that, guys. You own that.
Well, in the association context, the board member doesn't, president of the board of directors is not the client.
It's the association.
Right, it's the association itself. So the board president or the officer or director also has a duty to the association, would arguably include keeping confidential matters confidential. So
I think some things ought to be confidential. I think especially when you're going out to bid for certain things, because you want to be taken seriously, and you don't want to be out there saying, oh, A bid so much and B bid so much. I mean, that I totally agree with. I think any problem between a homeowner and the association, when you think about it, associations were initially designed and built with the idea that it belonged to the homeowners and the homeowners would participate in it gradually over the years. That has changed to where the homeowner is nothing more than the ATM and is kept at arm's distance, and the board makes all the decisions and leaves the homeowners out of it. Bill, you want to jump in there?
Wow, you've summed it up. You were talking about John summing up things earlier. You summed it up in even fewer words. I like that. Mandatory funders, that's all you are. I don't even like using the word association. We've talked about this before.
Yeah, we have.
And I refuse to use it in court filings because, honestly, the jury's confused, the judge is confused, people are confused. I went to a meeting a few weeks ago we're a realtor. Yes, that's with the little trademark, registered trademark symbol, realtor, stood up and said, don't you have to get the homeowner's approval for this? She's talking to the board. After all, we are the association. No, lady, you're not. You don't get it. The association is a corporation completely separate from you. And this is one of these types that's going around and telling the homeowners, oh, it's your clubhouse. It's your roads. It's your, no, it's not yours. It's not yours at all. It belongs to the organization. And it's very important to keep that distinction separate. I want to go into a very brief story, if I may.
Yes.
You can cut it out later if you don't like it. But I've been asked to go, I was asked by a fellow to represent him in arbitration. And I went to, and that's why he contacted me. And I looked at his paperwork. There's a pre-arbitration mediation requirement. But his, this is a very strange organization. And all he's trying to do is put a metal roof on a shed, or actually it's an RV barn. He's in a rural area, and there's RV barns are permitted, and they're throughout the subdivision. However, and the subdivision is like 3 to 15 acre parcels. However, the board member doesn't want him to be able to have a metal roof. And if you can imagine this, trying to put a shingle structure on a metal building, it's just not...
The picture is kind of weird, Bill.
Right. And it's expensive, and it's just, this is just an annoyance, you know? And so the board, I know this board is just so convinced that they can force people to arbitration because before arbitration, you have to go to mediation, but after mediation, it says that either side can demand arbitration. So their goal is to cut you out of being able to go to court. But if you look a little more closely, and remember, this guy hired me to go to the arbitration, but I looked at his restrictive covenants, and it actually says a dispute among the members. Okay, that's number one. I said, this isn't a dispute among members. And people, this is, so whoever wrote this failed to understand the distinction between the members and the corporation. This is a dispute between a member and the HOA corporation. There's no requirement to go to arbitration. You can force them into court. This board doesn't realize that. They think they have the upper hand. That's number one. Number two, this one had another provision I hadn't really seen anywhere else, and it allows you to resign your membership. You still have the obligation to pay assessments and everything else, and the board, you have to apply for reinstatement, and the board can choose whether to reinstate you or not. But if you think about it, if that's the case, and even if a court were to read this as requiring a dispute, you know, a dispute with the HOA was a dispute among the members, we just go, okay, we're resigning membership, and the heck with you, and we're going to court. I mean, it was just such a ridiculously written document. But I'm just saying, hey, they screw up these arbitration things. They put things, I mean, why is the HOA going to be involved in a dispute, quote, among the members? That's between the members. It has nothing to do with the HOA.
I think you make a great point, Bill, that just because someone is telling an owner that they have to go to arbitration doesn't necessarily mean that a judge is going to agree with
right.
their reading of that of the governing documents, or that, I mean, or may even be that the governing documents don't, there's no real ambiguity there, and they, you know, it's, they're just, someone's just making up something for the sake of convenience. So it's a good reminder that it's usually in the homeowner's best interest to understand their governing documents when a dispute comes up. And I don't know how many times that I've that these things do come up, and homeowners don't have copies of their governing documents, or have not considered them before they get to the attorney. It's just something nice to have in your files, just so that if a board member tells you something, or a property member manager tells you something, at least you can go and verify that without having to go down to the courthouse and spend an hour and a half digging through land records.
Well, the thing too, let me jump in here with that. I've heard of and seen and known of cases where the board will have several different versions of the declaration in the desk drawer. So whatever they're discussing, and you say, well, show me where you get your authority from, and they'll pull out the appropriate set of declarations, and they'll say, right here it is. It says I can come to dinner every Sunday, and you can't kick me out. And you sort of think, okay. I tell people, go to the courthouse, get a copy. at least check it out and make sure that what you have is accurate, because that's the only one that's valid.
Or it may be that the government documents have been amended 20 times during the time that the developer owned the property or had a majority interest. So it might be that there have been, you know, 5 or 10 different official effective versions of the government documents, but there's only going to be one that's going to be in effect at the time that the homeowner needs it. So it's good to know that, even though it might be disheartening to find out that you have to sort through hundreds of pages of documents to determine which set of declarations and covenants are the ones that you have to contend with.
I haven't been to the courthouse in a while, but I know that with computers now, a lot of things are automated and you can just go in and pull them up. So if they're not done, they should be done. Lean on your local jurisdiction to do them. You shouldn't have to spend days camping out at the courthouse going through boxes of stuff or going through piles of microfiche. I did that years ago, but there's no need for that anymore.
It's also nice to know whether or not your association has recorded a lien against you without telling you about it. That's something that is also good to verify when you're doing those kind of things.
So I know, and they're expensive, so I tell them, take a copy of what you have and then make sure that, you know, if there are any changes, just get the page that you need and pull it out from the court. Do you agree, Bill?
Yes. I would add that I'm not sure which part you're talking about. At least here, the types of records you're talking about would be found at the county clerk's office, the restricted covenants and any affidavits of lien or documents like that they filed, whereas the judgments and court proceedings would be found in, say, the district court or county court records.
Right. In each jurisdiction, whether it's Texas, Virginia, or elsewhere, there's going to be, I imagine there's going to be a different place that a homeowner would have to go to find different types of records. So, you know, I guess these things are just, whatever, you know, it's, you know, in Virginia, there's a specific place where judgments are recorded or liens are recorded, whereas in Texas, you know, it might be different.
I wanted to bring up one other thing on arbitration on that issue. This same case where I looked at the restricted covenants and even the bylaws, and they adopted the same language. It's like, so we don't actually have to go there, but their longtime attorney is convinced that they do. Their longtime attorney has said that, the reason they allowed a metal roof on this other building was because those people wanted to implement a rainwater collection system. Okay, that's basically arbitrary and capricious. Why don't we just say we want to implement one, and then we decide we don't want to this year or next year or the next year? But the point is that arbitrary and capricious type of conduct is never going to come to light if we can't get it into the public record and we're stuck with something like arbitration. We want court in that type of situation. We don't want arbitration. And in a rural area, I'm a little concerned about who the arbitrator is going to be and what their alliances are. They're supposed to be independent. But the reality is, you know, if you go to arbitration, who's the return and repeat customer? It's the HOA.
Right.
And I'm a little concerned about the bias by an arbitrator and their independence. And although, at least in this state, and at least with, like, American Arbitration Association, they've developed a route for appealing an arbitration decision. They actually have an appellate arbitration panel now. But generally arbitration decisions aren't appealable, unlike court, where you can have problems with either local corruption or a judge who's, you know, I've seen this all the time. Oh, Your Honor, these are just volunteers. Yeah,
yeah.
So are petty thieves and everybody else. It's called intentional conduct, Your Honor. They're volunteers. And they'll say, oh, the homeowners, and the judge thinks that he's responding to the voting populace, as opposed to realizing that this is a corporation and it only represents the interests of the majority of the board members. It does not represent the interests of the homeowners, much less the guy who actually is voting, who's the other party in this thing. But at least with an appeal, you can get it up to a higher jurisdiction that is not, you know, they're not in the area. They're not worried, for the most part, about the people there, the HOA there, or anything else. But it's being able to get to an independent tribunal, and I like that aspect of court and the ability to correct it if there's errors or that you can show prejudice. You can't do that with arbitration. And arbitration, they also don't have to follow the rules of evidence, okay? And some people may complain about those things, but if you think about it, the homeowner's not going to be the one that has the experience with who's a decent arbitrator to get. The board's going to be experienced with the arbitrator that they want.
Yes.
And so is the attorney representing the board. They may even be part of the same trade group without mentioning, you know, three little letters.
You want me to do that for you?
Well, you could. You could. And, you know, who do you think that they're going to vote for, especially when they know the homeowner's got no recourse, there's no appeal, there's nothing the homeowner can do about it. You know, there's literally no recourse. So that's why I like court. And plus the other homeowners, one of the other problems for the, well, I'm going to call them the victim homeowner. One of the problems for the victim homeowner is the board will often, this is not fought just on a judicial forum or an arbitration forum. It's fought in a social forum as well. And these board members and often the management company will engage in a real nasty social vendetta against the homeowners. You know, oh, they're harming property values, this type of stuff. It's psychological as well. They'll say, oh, we won this, or the court held this. You know what? The only way to validate that stuff is to actually put the court decision or the motions that are pending, you know, on a website or make them available for people to see. Because in the absence of that, you've got people being able to lie, like board members, about what's going on. Even if arbitration is working for the homeowner, or even if the homeowner's not winning, if you in the abstract look at it and say, hey, the arbitration is it's okay, it's fair, it's independent, regardless of who's winning, you'll find the board members misrepresenting the outcome of that to the other homeowners, both to fool
all
them
the time,
and also to create make it very uncomfortable for the victim homeowner to continue living in the subdivision, or, you know, just trying to make their lives miserable. And so I think you need to have some kind of public, open, it's why I don't like the courthouse, but you need to have some kind of openness there to keep the board members and the vendors honest about what's going on.
You have to be able to withstand public scrutiny, otherwise you're doing something wrong. John actually found a case that he wants to talk about. It. It's right on point regarding the confidentiality clause.
Right, and also it is an example of the kind of public record of this kind of vindictive behavior. This is a case from 2008. It's in North Carolina. It involves a homeowners association in rural, or rather suburban, Charlotte, North Carolina. A friend of mine, an attorney friend of mine in Charlotte, North Carolina, has explained to me that this the section of Charlotte, there's a lot of gentrification going on, where you have these little cute little garden apartments that are being transformed into these kind of gentrified condominiums. Well, in this community, Selwyn Village, there was a flood. I imagine that's something that's common in both new and renovated condominiums, and the homeowners, the board, made a claim under their insurance that the property manager had gone out and procured for them. But then when they made that claim, they discovered that the property manager had grossly underinsured the flood coverage, so that, you know, that I guess they were out there doing the good work of saving, cutting the budget and saving people money. Unfortunately, when they needed it, it wasn't available. So it appears that Selwyn Village fired their property manager, this company called Klein & Company, and sued them for being a bad property manager. And the case continued, and it must have been pretty contentious, because it continued on into trial. The trial was about 3 years after this flood occurred, and on the third day of trial, the parties agreed in principle to a settlement where the property manager would pay the association. I know Bill doesn't like that word, but the corporate entity.
The homeowners didn't get any money.
Right.
But the corporate entity.
They agreed to pay them $26,000, and that there would also be a confidentiality and non-disparagement provision to the settlement. And this sounds like a homeowner or a victory, and you've got a misbehaving industry operator, and then they get fired, and then the homeowners sue them, and then they get them to agree to a settlement. But if you look between the lines here, $26,000 for for flood damage for a condominium complex, I mean, really, I mean, $26,000, you might fix, you know, a little bit of something, but not a whole lot, especially in an urban area like Charlotte, North Carolina, where you've got, you know, big banks are headquartered there. And so they agreed, they managed to get the trial taken off the calendar, and that this amount would be paid, and that later on they would work out all these nice little details about confidentiality, and they had put them into an order of some kind. What happened was is that the lawyers for the association, their board, invited them to go to an owners' meeting to explain to the owners what had happened at the trial and what the terms were of the settlement. So you can imagine, the lawyers arriving there and kind of, you know, wanting to present this as a victory, but at the same time there is this confidentiality issue, blah blah blah. But what happened was is that the daughter-in-law of the property manager owned a unit in the condominium association. So she went to the daughter-in-law of the property manager went to that meeting where the lawyer was going to talk about the settlement, and she brought a tape recorder and she recorded it. And so this, of course, is very salacious. She took that back to her lawyer or her property management company's lawyer, and property management company typed that up, and then they refused to pay the very generous $26,000 settlement because the confidentiality oral agreement had been breached, and the whole thing was void, and homeowners, you no longer get, to get to put this to a jury, and you no longer get your settlement. Good luck with your new homeowners association. So, but in this case, the judge agreed with the homeowners and awarded them the $26,000, and then the property manager appealed it up throughout the appellate system in North Carolina, and eventually the Court of Appeals agreed that there wasn't really a grounds for appeal here, that the way that things were handled were proper, and that the trial court properly enforced the $26,000 settlement amount as a judgment. And this case is what I like about this case is that it shows all the different things that can go wrong, that sometimes as a homeowner, you need to know, or as any party that's trying to settle a case, you need to know the different ways that something can be just derailed and can get off into the weeds and off track so you can spot these issues, so that you don't have to defend against these things. And it also shows some of the kind of sharp tactics that people can use who are determined to get what they want.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention, John. But I think that kind of makes my point in a way. if it can't withstand public scrutiny, then there's something wrong and you're going to have some problems.
Right. This is kind of the Streisand effect going on here, where this property manager wanted to keep things under the rug with this confidentiality clause, and then they had to appeal it and put all this up there into public record and force an appeals judge to write out a public opinion that could be found by somebody like me and then talked about on a radio show like this. So it's a little ironic. Sometimes if you just settle things properly, then the hot head of steam kind of cools off and people kind of move on, and you don't need to cover these things up or to appeal them so that you can vindicate yourself and punish someone. No, it's there's a better way of doing these things than, you know, there are better ways to do it than these kind of tactics.
I agree, because I've heard from so many homeowners. I mean, I've heard from a number of people who were being fined $1 million for allegedly sort of defaming a board member. And then you end up, well, we can't talk about it, and when it's all over with, we'll talk about it and we'll find out what's going on, and they'll come on the show. They settle. They end up settling with a confidentiality clause. I can't talk to you. Now, you know that if the homeowner had lost and had to pay the association, there would be no confidentiality clause. You know that it's usually the other way around, and you know that it's the HOA money that's being used, not the board member who decided to become a hothead and go after this homeowner.
Yeah.
And that's where I have a problem.
I just have to generally, I mean, I can understand there's some value between rational parties, voluntary parties, by the way. You don't have a voluntary relationship with this HOA homeowner deal. And I, you know, people go, oh, you chose it when you bought the property. No,
it's
voluntary membership. And what you have in most jurisdictions in the country these days of any size is the only thing that's voluntary is which HOA you have to belong to, not whether there's going to be an HOA or, you know, type of thing. And so I don't buy into that at all. But although between rational, voluntary type relationships, or even some tort claims, there may be valid reasons for having a confidential settlement agreement. I don't think that those reasons really apply in the context of HOA burdened housing. And plus, there's financial records that, you know, how are you going to keep something confidential and yet keep your records up to date? And I also don't think it's appropriate to keep it secret, even if insurance pays a component of it, because you've got a whole other industry problem there with them claiming, you know, they have to hike premiums to cover certain losses that they don't actually have to show any evidence of. And I think it's bad if insurance companies can cover up claims that are paid out. So I generally would not be a proponent of confidential settlement agreements from the perspective of the homeowner. If I'm the management company, the HOA attorney, and the HOA, and the insurance company, the HOA, of course I want to keep them secret. But they're supposed to be working, supposedly, for the benefit of the homeowner, which we all, of course, know is not the case. So I'd have to say, generally, I'm opposed to arbitration unless the homeowner agrees to it after the decision or after the conflict arose, not as a function of mandate by restrictive covenants. They can always choose, and that the settlement, the parties could choose for it to be secret, but that generally they should be open, and like arbitration decisions should be available and court decisions should be available, because otherwise you can't do anything about a systemic problem where you have board members doing the same thing over and over and over again, goes up to arbitration, it's privately resolved at somebody else's expense, and then they just repeat, rinse and repeat.
I have a question for Shu and Bill. Do you all think that, let's say that there was legislation passed in, it doesn't, we could say Virginia, Texas, it doesn't really matter, a jurisdiction that provided that there's to be no confidentiality clauses in settlements between owners and community associations. Do you think that the industry responds? I mean, I think that that legislation's very unlikely to be passed due to some issues that are probably don't have time to get into. But if let's say that it were to be passed, do you think that the industry response would be to force the association to fight the case down to the in a scorched earth fashion to the last possible venue, whether it's trial or an appeal or otherwise, because they don't want the homeowner to get the last word if, let's say, details get out in a lawsuit or details come out at trial or so on. Do you think that it might kind of force the associations or incite them to just refuse to settle in order to try to maintain their innocence throughout the whole process? Or do you think that's unlikely?
I think sometimes what I've heard, sometimes you have issues where the association attorney will just push them, knowing full well that there's no way they're going to be able to win this in court. You know, once you've got some adult supervision over there and the judge is going to think, what on earth are you guys thinking? The attorneys don't want to get to that point. So, I mean, some of the stories I've heard along the lines, John, there's no way an attorney's going to go or a judge is going to go along with it. But it's a bully tactic. It's nothing more than a bully tactic. So they'll go right to the edge and then they'll say, okay, we'll settle, but you can't talk about it. And we'll give you money, but you can't talk about it. But if you do, then we'll take the money away from you, and then we'll take you to court, and then we'll threaten you, and then we'll do this, and then we'll do that. And in some cases, they've done that without being able to prove that the homeowner, in fact, has done anything or has talked.
Well, and could it also be viewed as a possibility for, again, you know, it depends on rational people and the incentives that are created. I mean, there's plenty of HOA attorneys, especially that work in the insurance defense, you know, they get hired by insurance for defense, that, hey, that's an annuity payment as long as litigation is going on. So why would we want to put an end to it? And that would be the case regardless of, you know, whether the confidentiality or anything else. But if you're dealing with rational parties, couldn't you also argue that there's an incentive to want to try and quickly settle before a bunch of details come out? Or to just agree to resolve all claims, blah, blah, blah. Because if you draw the thing out, you know, people are going to file more pleadings, complaining about the actions of these board members. You're going to have depositions. That kind of stuff can get out.
That's a really interesting response, because I think what you're saying is that rather than making it impossible for a homeowner to favorably resolve a case short of trial and appeal, that this might, a rule like that might actually
accelerate
that process, because the prospect of buying silence wouldn't be available. So that's a good idea.
Well, I'm just saying it's possible, but again, it depends upon the motivations. If you think about these HOA attorneys, a bunch of them, I'm not saying all of them. I mean, there's people that, you know, defend HOAs and don't do this type of stuff, but it's not their money.
Yeah.
They're getting paid.
Yeah.
What do they care? And they're going to get hired again because the HOA can't be killed, unlike the homeowners who have a finite life and limited resources. The HOA has an insurance policy it can draw from, you know, all things considered, and it can always assess the homeowners. And often it has a war chest from years of collecting assessments. The homeowner's not in that situation. And so I one other point along there, an HOA attorney in the case, one of the cases I was involved in, they actually came out and said, I don't want to demean Walmart, but they claimed that they were going to put on the Walmart defense. We're like, well, what's that? He said, well, the policy is $1 million policy, and that includes claim and representation, and we're going to make sure that it's all spent on attorney's fees and there won't be anything left over for the claims. But we could care less if the HOA had to dig and pay its own money. I mean, that's one of the problems, isn't it, right? The moral hazard, if you're not on the hook for paying the claim, then what's going to limit your authority? Try and find insurance like that for homeowners.
Gentlemen, I think I'm going to call this part one because I think there's a lot more. Can we do part two sometime?
Sure.
I had fun. Thank you very much, John and Bill. Thank you so much for joining
us.
Thank you, Shu. It's been fun, too.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.